And now I would like to turn it over to Tim and Andrea. Take it away.
Well, thanks, Chris. I'm going to go first. I'm Andrea Gironis, and I'm going to speak first, and then Tim's going to talk a little bit more at the end of my presentation. So I'm going to start by sharing my screen, if I can find it. There we go. Can everybody see that all right, Chris?
Yes, we can. Thanks.
All right. I'm going to get going then. So one of the things that I plan on talking about this evening is astrophotography and essentially how digital cameras have really changed how we can take photographs of space from Earth. And I'm going to begin by saying I am not a scientist. I'm not an engineer. I'm not even a computer person. I am actually a lawyer and I do personal injury law. And this is my hobby. And as a result, I have joined the Royal Astronomical Society, the Ottawa Center. And everybody here is encouraged to come to one of our monthly meetings, which we have every month, the first Friday night. They are open of every month. They are open to the public. So where to start? And this is a huge topic, astrophotography, but essentially, if you have a general interest in Earth photography, a lot of this will be a natural extension. You can do astrophotography with a regular camera. Ideally, it's one that has interchangeable lenses like a DSLR or a mirrorless camera. Fast lenses and fast optics are helpful for nighttime photography. And because this is a computer users group, you guys will have a huge head start because we need computers for everything now with astrophotography. It will help you locate your targets. There's a website called Stellarium.com, and there's also an app called Stellarium. They're slightly different. They are very, very useful. I use another website called Telescopius.com. It helps me plan my imaging. You will acquire images with software. You will then take all your images, stack them, and process them. And of course, you will search the internet for regular, for your favorite YouTuber, and you will learn from them. So there are many different types of astrophotography, and I want to make sure that I can't cover them all today, but I can cover deep sky objects. I'm going to talk about that in detail. But a lot of people focus on Milky Way photography. If that interests you, I can direct you to some really great people. Lots of people like to just do the moon, rising and setting. Some people love the moon. I personally am not a big moon fan because it affects my deep space photography. And then there's high resolution planetary images, which you can do from Earth, and they are amazing, but it's quite a different setup. You require a very large telescope. You need a lot of different kinds of software. That's a whole other issue. However, deep sky objects like nebula and galaxies can be photographed from Earth relatively easily. And that's what I'm going to talk about today. So when we talk about nebulas, why they're such good targets is they tend to be very big. They are big and they are diffuse. And they can be hard to see visually because they are so spread out and so large. However, a camera sensor can pick them up very easily. These are star-forming regions in our galaxy and sometimes in other galaxies. And as the stars form, when they first form, they are very bright, very hot, and they illuminate everything around them. So very often with a large nebula, there is a core of stars and it'll light everything up. Photographically, these nebulas tend to appear as red or pink in photographs because the emissions are primarily a hydrogen alpha, and that tends to be represented in the red color spectrum of light. And I'm not a scientist, and I can't explain all of that. This picture that I have, of course, is not a true color. It's been a false color image, which is another story. But there are actually nebulas that are blue, and they are reflection nebula, and very rarely you can have a yellow nebula. There are also supernova remnants that are very big and very bright, and they emit in hydrogen and oxygen, and they are wonderful targets as well. So if you are doing any kind of searching online, or you on Instagram looking at deep sky images, everything out there, for the most part, will involve two concepts, tracking and stacking. Tracking is the mechanical aspect of nighttime photography. The stars move, at least we are moving, but they appear to move. So you must mount your camera on a tracker, and it'll be tracking the stars as they move through the night sky. Or you can use what's called an equatorial mount, and I'll explain what that is. But nowadays, most of them are computerized, they are go-to mounts, and once they are set up properly, they will track your image through the sky. Once you take several images while the camera is tracking, you can then stack the images, which helps increase the signal-to-noise ratio. So you will have more signal, and you'll be able to eliminate the background noise. And that is the magic of digital photography. In the old days, we used to literally, when we used film, we would open the shutter and we would have to keep the shutter open for an hour. Now we can just do 60-second exposures and stack a whole bunch of them. You can start, and we always recommend you start with camera equipment you already have. Why do we need to track the stars? In your photograph, you want pinpoint stars. Some people do star trail photography, which is a different kind of photography. But this, most of the time, we want pinpoint stars. And we want to do long exposure. We want as much light as possible. The more light, the better. However, without a tracker, after about 20 or 30 seconds in a wide-angle lens, you will notice motion. This is just an example of one night when I was messing around with my camera, and I took star trails by accident. This is actually a picture of the Orion Nebula, and I was not tracking this image because I was trying to get the foreground in focus, and to do that, I had properly exposed the foreground. I had to overexpose and not track the sky. So this is just 3 minutes. That is how much the stars will move in 3 minutes. So what you really do, you need to have a tracker that will stay with those stars for your whole 3 minutes. This is a photograph that I took from my backyard in Ottawa with a 50 millimeter lens, which is a standard lens you get if you have a DSLR. Using a star tracker, I took 10 images of 3 minutes each, and they were all tracked. Then I stacked them. And this is what I got. It was kind of a test run, but it shows what you can do with just regular camera equipment in your backyard. This glowy thing, by the way, is Orion's Nebula. It's visible in the early morning. It'll be more and more visible as the winter goes on. It's a famous winter constellation. It's a very, very bright nebula, and it's a very popular first target. And this is what it looks like close up. And it's a very popular target. And it's one of the easiest ones to start. It is very dramatic and very rewarding for a first image as well. All right, so many people then begin their astrophotography journey with a star tracker. And if you are interested in doing a star tracker, and it's a lot less expensive than an equatorial mount, these are three popular brands I have listed, and there was a presentation that I did in May for Astronomy Day in Ottawa, and it was all about star trackers, so you can pop over there if you would like. This is really a manual mechanical thing, the star tracker. There's no computer involved. This is the computerized go-to mount that I also own. And because this is a computer group, obviously you want to talk about this. This is a picture of a Celestron Schmidt-Cassegrain telescope. So the optical tube is an 11-inch of aperture, and it's a Schmidt-Cassegrain tube. And it doesn't look like your typical telescope, but it's the one I have. It is mounted on a computerized go-to mount. And as you can see, there's a little hand controller there. And without any computers attached at all, I can just use the hand controller. I can do an alignment routine with three stars in the sky. I have to locate them and center them with a guide scope and with the eyepiece. And once I've aligned my telescope, I can then input information into the hand controller and it will automatically locate whatever target I'm looking at. So you don't need a computer to do astronomy with a go-to mount. I will say this, you do need to have some knowledge of the night sky before you go out and buy a big guy like this, because you need to be able to spot the stars. I spent several years not using this big telescope because I had trouble doing the alignment routine. But the pandemic changed all that and I got to spend the time with it. However, if you decide to do astrophotography, you can connect your computer to the hand controller that then talks to the mount. And once you attach your computer, you open up a whole world of possibilities of controlling this telescope. There's something called the ASCOM protocol, and don't ask me what it is, but it's a standardized protocol for all programs to speak to the mount. What that means then is if you pull up a program on your computer called Stellarium and you type in, let's say, the North American Nebula, and you say, I want to look at that target, it will then communicate to your mount and it will locate it. If you have a camera attached, it'll go one step further. It'll take a picture of the sky. It'll look at all the stars. It'll compare the stars to all the databases, and it will determine where your telescope is pointing. And it'll say, oh, you're not actually pointing in the right spot. I have to do a correction, and it'll correct to the correct coordinates. That's called plate solving. And it's the magical thing about computerized mounts. It's very, very helpful. All right. That's a lot of information, but basically once you connect a computer and a camera, you can find your way through the sky very easily. This is a YouTuber that I quite enjoy. He's from Australia, Dylan O'Donnell, and he has a whole video on plate solving. What is plate solving? And I think it's really critical if you go into this area to have some idea of what this is, because it is the magic. It's just incredible. One of the things that a lot of the software uses plate solving for is something called polar alignment, and we're going to get to that. But because we are tracking a target through the sky, the mount has to be aligned towards the north celestial pole, because everything rotates around the north celestial pole. Our north pole is basically right at the north celestial pole, not exactly, but pretty close. So there are a lot of pieces of software that help you polar align. SharpCap is one of them. It is a free software. It has an upgrade. It's like $40 to upgrade to have more functionality. Stellarium is another piece of software that will help you locate targets. There is a free software out there called Nina, and it's becoming very, very popular amongst people for acquisition software. We'll come to that. You'll notice that this telescope here has a second telescope on top. The second telescope is called a guide scope. So not only is your mount tracking your object while you're doing your imaging, you also have a a guide scope on top, and there's a little guide camera that is also connected to your computer. And the guiding will even fine tune the tracking even more. It'll select a guide star and it'll follow that star. And that's PhD software. It's a software used around the globe. Everybody who does auto guiding uses PhD. So all of this software is downloaded onto your computer. As you can see, it's often set up in a small table beside your telescope outside. And you sit down at your little table, and with all the cables connected, you can select a target, send your telescope towards that target, take some pictures, plate solve the location. If you're not quite centered, you can, the software will move the mount, recenter, take another picture, and then eventually, magically, your target, there it is, right in the middle. So that's why we love plate solving. I see some chats showing up. Is there anything I should look at right now? Yeah, big battery, yes. I'm going to say that the battery, you need power to do this if you're going to do it remotely. I am lucky enough that I can run it from my backyard, and I have all my power cables. I also have several batteries for when I do go and do remote imaging. Yes, equatorial mounts track, yes, that's true, go in both directions. So it will track generally in right ascension. Instead of north, we have, those are the coordinates, right ascension and declination. And declination is up and down. The mount will technically track in all directions, and then the guide scope will do corrections in declination and right ascension. So between the guide scope and good polar alignment, you have pretty good tracking. And I'm going to talk here, the ASI Air is a mini computer that I happen to use, and it is very, it's very easy. It has all the software you need in one little box, and it's very useful. Of course, the phone rings. Okay. I'm going to ignore the phone. So polar alignment. If you ever want to know how to find the North Star, this is a graphic that illustrates it. Everybody knows where the Big Dipper is. If you take the two bottom stars from the Big Dipper, they are called the pointer stars, and they will point to Polaris. I'm talking so much. Okay. So plate solving is also very useful for polar alignment. Next, you need acquisition software. So you can either use a DSLR or you can use an astronomical camera. excuse me. You will need a software that controls your camera, and what the software will do is it'll program a series of exposures. So you'll say, I want to run 20 5-minute exposures or 200 1-minute exposure. And that's what the software will do. And then it'll download the data to your computer. It can also control the gain, which is like the ISO of a regular camera, and temperature. A lot of astronomical cameras are cooled, and that's why we like them, because a DSLR is not cooled. So when it's open and working for hours upon hours, you tend to get hot pixels. So astronomical cameras are cooled to keep the sensor very cold. Acquisition software can also run filters. If you have a filter wheel that is electronic, you can have the software say, okay, we're going to do the blue filter, then the red filter, then the green filter, and then hydrogen alpha. Some people have autofocusers so that they can run an autofocus sequence. So when the temperature changes, it'll try to do an autofocus sequence. And of course, your acquisition software, speaking with your the computerized mount between the two of them, they can do plate solving, which is wonderful, as I've mentioned. Starting costs. Yeah, we'll come to price. You can, the rabbit hole is very deep in astrophotography. You can spend an awful lot of money. Start with what you have, and then you'll figure out pretty quick, what is your pain point? Is it a new mount? Is it a better camera? Is it a better computer to handle all of the software? So that's kind of the way most people approach it. One thing at a time, because the more variables you add in, the trickier it can get. Okay, I'm going to keep going. So obviously, excellent guiding and tracking is key. That's how you have the pinpoint stars. Essentially, what people recommend for astrophotography is a small telescope and a big mount. So this is the same mount that I had before with an 11-inch scope, but this is a much smaller telescope. And the stability is great because it's a good solid mount to support a lighter telescope. And what people do, they do fall into the aperture fever, we call it, where you want bigger and bigger and bigger telescopes. But the bigger your telescope, the harder it is to have excellent guiding and perfect tracking. So I always, everybody will recommend that you start with a small refractor telescope. The one I have here is one of the smallest. It's called the Red Cat 51. It's a 250 millimeter focal length. And it's a four-piece, I don't know, some kind of special kind of telescope that is very, very flat field across. I love it. It's a beautiful little scope. It's a perfect astrophotography scope. And you can see on top, I have a small little guide camera and guide telescope. Okay. So this is an example of an image that I could take with the Red Cat. This is the Horsehead Nebula. This is actually an interesting nebula because it's not visible visually. It's almost impossible to see, but photographically, it's very bright. This is 47 times 5 minute exposure. I had a guide camera. I used an equatorial mount. And this was pretty early on. I believe I just stacked it in Deep Sky Stacker. It's a free software. You just acquire your images and you dump them in and it stacks it for you. Okay, I think I spoke about this a bit. So the small refractor is key, a guide scope and guide camera. I went to an astro camera, but you can connect a DSLR to the Red Cat. And that's how I started. I began with my DSLR that I already had and I attached it. There's a little attachment ring. I use an ASI Air mini computer. And I'll talk about this in a minute. But it's a small mini computer. I don't know what else to say about it, but it comes pre-installed with the acquisition software and the guiding software. And I just plug everything in and it runs all of my cameras. All right. And so because this is a wide field, 250 millimeters is considered very wide. It's a lot easier to do tracking and guiding. As you get better at this job, this hobby, I should say, you can go narrower, but as you go to longer focal lengths, it becomes harder to have perfect guiding. So everybody should start with a wide angle refractor. This is my ASI Air. So basically, yep, it has all the software you need. It's controlled over Wi-Fi, so that I can follow it. I can connect it to the Wi-Fi in my house, and I can sit in the house with my iPad, and I can watch whatever's going on. Like right now, I have an imaging run going, and I can watch it on my iPad, which is really nice when it's January in Ottawa. And it's portable. And I don't know this for sure, but I've had people tell me that when they go out in the field and they're running on a battery, it's much less power intensive than running a computer laptop off of a battery in the field. So lots of people like it for going away from home. Okay. The other website that I really, really like is Telescopius, because it helps you plan your imaging and plan your targets. You obviously want a night that has no moon, because the moon tends to brighten up the whole sky, which is not good for astrophotography. And you want to have a big, bright nebula, because they are the easiest ones. So we're going to go. I'm just going to get out of this and go share a different screen. Bear with me. New share. Okay, there we go. So this is the website Telescopius. And if you just go to the main page, you'll see what's in the sky tonight. And you can pick, it suggests some popular nebula. So one thing we might want to pick is the Pelican Nebula, for example. Let's go click on that one. And it'll show some pictures, but it has a lot of information. So for example, over here on the right-hand side, it'll show you when this nebula rises and when it sets. And you can see right when the sun goes down, the nebula is straight up and it slowly descends. And that's really good, because you don't have to flip over the meridian. You can just line it up and follow it until dawn. You might, if you look at some of the other objects, you'll see that it's very low in the south and it never really gets high enough. Well, maybe that's not a good target. But what I do love is right here, you'll see that this is the Pelican Nebula when I used my 540 millimeter telescope. And one of my cameras, which is an APS size sensor. So I can go here and pick different cameras. I have a camera with a different sensor. You'll see it zooms in. If I put a different telescope here, these are not all my telescopes. These are just, I play around with different things. This is one of my telescopes, the William Optics. And you see the field of view changes. And with a different camera, it changes again. So I decide if I want to have a broader view, I use this combination, or I can zoom in. And if I'm in this neighborhood, I can go down here and it'll suggest other nebulas nearby, like the Crescent Nebula, for example, is nearby. And there it is. But that's kind of zoomed out, so I might want to use a different camera and get a little closer. So I really like this. So you have to spend a little time. I have to input my cameras. I have to input the telescopes and also some of my camera lenses. For example, this is an 85 millimeter lens. You can see it really zooms out. And that would be kind of a nice picture too. So this is where I plan my targets and how I'm going to frame them in different telescopes. So I'm going to put that down now. I'm going to share the other one. Okay, a new share. All right, back to the presentation. All right, so checking my time. Okay, I still have some time. Anything I need to do? Oh, it looks like Tim is answering all the questions. That's fantastic. Great. This is the California Nebula, by the way. It's very big and very bright. It's another nice target. So, for example, it's really important when you're going to go out and try astrophotography that you do pick a target. You want a big target. You want a bright target. They'll be easy to find, easy to know that you're framing them well. These are examples. I think almost all of them were taken with a DSLR. So you'll see the Andromeda Galaxy. It's a very big and bright. We have the North American Nebula that we looked at Telescopius. And there's a supernova remnant at the bottom. These are all very big and bright, and they are accessible with a camera. But only in the summer. In the winter has a whole bunch of different ones, such as Orion. Orion is a great target. This is the Hart Nebula, is in the fall. It's kind of rising now. The Horsehead, and the Pleiades. The Pleiades is a star cluster. You can see them naked eye. You'll be able to see them rising in the east, southeast right now, if it's clear. And there is a bit of blue reflection nebula around them. So that's also a very pretty target. Unfortunately, this is the bad news. Capturing the images is just the beginning of your journey in astrophotography. Now you have to do image processing, and that is a whole other world of excitement. Number one, after you've got the images, you have to stack them. Stacking is easy. Software does it all. But then you have to process it. And process usually involves something called stretching. And if you're familiar with Photoshop or if you use any kind of image processing, stretching means you adjust the histogram. You're going to brighten up. You want to stretch your histogram because all the data is in the dark end and you need to stretch it out. When you first see your stack coming out of Deep Sky Stacker, it's almost black. So you need a lot of stretching. You might need to color calibrate, and you'll spend more time on YouTube learning how to do all of this. So stacking really does benefit the more images, the more the stacking program can differentiate between the noise of the sky and the image itself. Lots of free software to stack, lots of tutorials. Starry Sky is for Mac, but the other ones are Windows only. There's advanced stacking and a program called PixInsight. It's an astronomical program. It's specialized for astronomy. And this is the best picture I could find that illustrates stacking. You literally are just piling on the data, and eventually the actual object signal becomes clearer and extracted from the background. That is how faint a lot of this is. And even with all this information, your stacked image is still very dark. So here's some examples. So this is a single, I say single image. I actually had to stretch this to even show it to you guys. But this is essentially what one single 60-second image would look like of this galaxy called NGC 4725. It's very cute. And it has two friends on each side. After stacking, this is what it looks like. This is stacking only 67 seconds. I would have liked more. And you can see we're already seeing a lot more detail in the center of this galaxy. And we're seeing actually in both, even the little small galaxies. Still amazes me that we can do this kind of stuff. So for image processing, you have kind of two choices. You can use standard photography image processing like Photoshop, or you can go to specialized software. And I use PixInsight a lot, but I always end up back in Photoshop at the very end for the final things that make it pretty. But the astronomical software does a lot of work on the image before you even stretch it. So, and this is the Shark Nebula. I think this is a fun one too. And these are blue nebulas. These are the reflection nebulas that I was talking about. And that's just dark dust in space. Most of this image processing software is not free, unfortunately. Most of it needs, there are some free programs out there and you'd have to research them, but they are not inexpensive. So image processing has various steps. The first one was we do something called calibration, and I won't bore you with that, but we end up taking bias frames, dark frames, and flat frames. You'll see, I think, back here, how there's a bit of a gradient. There's like a glow in the center. I have to use flat frames to correct that. Stretching the histogram, gradient removal, and then we do some color saturation, contrast, and that kind of work. So I'm not kidding that taking the photos is just the beginning. So once we get from a stacked image, this is totally unprocessed, and after some processing, you would get something that looks more like this. And even this image, I keep wanting to go back and reprocess because you're never quite happy with them. So all that to say is you have to keep it simple at the beginning. It's a big learning curve, but you just go step by step by step. Use what you have. Learn the sky. look at the free software, join the RASC. It's really reasonably priced. All of our meetings actually are free. You can just pop in and see what you think. There are a lot of Facebook groups, and there's maybe other kind of groups where you can find people who will support you, astrophotography for beginners, that kind of thing. There actually is a Royal Astronomical Society Facebook group. And spend too much time on YouTube. And I will just flag the, I think, the best ones. So these two, the first fellow is Trevor Jones. He's called Astro Backyard on YouTube. He's a great place to start. He has been doing astrophotography, I would say, on a budget for many, many years. That this telescope and this photo is not a budget scope. He's now made it a total career, but he is very, he does most of his astronomy from an urban area. So he talks a lot about filters and trying to image from the city, but he uses a range of telescopes and cameras. And Dylan O'Donnell is actually Australian, but he's very humorous, but he has a lot of very interesting videos on image processing. So these ones are good ones to start. And these are two other ones. Peter Zielinka is a photographer who uses primarily a star tracker. He just got a equatorial mount, but he's really good for somebody starting out with a camera. And because this is a computer group, I recommend Cuive the Lazy Geek. He does astrophotography from his roof in Tokyo. I don't know how, but he's quite technical. He loves to talk about the software, computers, processing. He talks about everything. He'll explain what flat frames are. He's very, very helpful. And you know what? You can do astrophotography with an iPhone. This is a growing field, and I'm sure it's going to get even better. Some of the new cameras are just amazing. You can put them, probably attach them to a star tracker. And this was my first image through an eyepiece of my telescope, and it's Saturn. And I just think Saturn is so cute in the eyepiece. It's not great. It's not going to win any prizes, but it was pretty exciting. And that is the end of my presentation. So I will take a quick look at the chat.
Ooh. Yeah, Tim's been doing a real good job of covering off the questions there. That was a pretty amazing presentation, Andrea. Being a photographer, I've often considered dabbling in astrophotography, but not sure that I'll get it together to do it. But certainly, you give me an awful lot of information if I do decide to pursue that.
Oh, if you're thinking of astrophotography, just have a beer and wait till the feeling passes.
Yeah.
Well, I will say there is a lunar eclipse. November 19th. It's a partial lunar eclipse. It's almost total, but get your camera out and point it to the west at around 2 a.m. You'll get something.
Yeah, not all that much, but I'm the lunatic. I'm a moon enthusiast. So you know.
Oh, one of those.
Yeah, one of those. I'm a lunatic and I'm also crazy. But at any rate, never mind. Forget it. My wife would attest to the lunatic part. Anyhow, I figure the moon's in the sky for a significant chunk of the month. You may as well just make the best of it.
Just for anybody's information there, Alan has been posting in some information, links and so forth to the Royal Astronomical Society Canada and the costs and so forth if you're interested in joining their group. So take a look at the chat for that if you're interested. The chat contents of the chat window will go up on our website later on tonight as well. So that'll be available to all for the future. We just had another question pop in. Do you have much light pollution where you live?
I am in suburban Ottawa. So I'm out near Carp. And there's definitely light pollution to the south. So pointing straight south, it is hard to image for me. It's not great, but straight up, a lot of things going on straight up and to the north is totally fine, apparently, from my backyard.
I'm near the sportsplex, and 10 years ago it was tolerable. Right now it's bloody awful. So if I want any kind of decent skies, I'll run out to the general carp area where we've got the club observatory. And no, you don't have to use the equipment there. You can just bring your own gear and use the grounds there. So, I don't know how the hell to follow Andrea's talk, because she covered everything.
There's no such thing as everything.
No, good Lord, no. Everything is for decadent minds. Why you were talking about your, you always want to go back and fiddle with your pictures. Well, finished artwork is for decadent minds, too. You don't finish a work of art, you abandon it. by the way, I do artwork and illustration, so I kind of know where I see. Andrea certainly got the astrophotography down. I dabble with it, and every now and again I'll make a picture that I'm willing to admit I made. Most of the stuff I've got is of the moon, and a few from Saturn, but a few of Saturn and Jupiter. I have at least one Mars picture that I'm willing to acknowledge, willing to admit I made. The rest, hit the bit bucket. But I have fun. Now, I was going to go over some software, so let's see if I can share the screen here. I'm only an engineer, but I think I can handle this. Share screen. Okay. All right, folks, pitch in here. What do we do next?
When you click the share, oh, there it looks like.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah, you're sharing.
Now, I've got a big raft of astronomy software up here. I'll just go over this briefly. These are ancient, by the way, Lunar Mapper Pro and Lunar Discoverer. There is a freeware piece out here called Virtual Moon Atlas. And I don't use it very much simply because it came out after I got used to my old stuff. But it's a pretty cool little program. And if you want to figure out what you're looking at on the moon, this will do the job for you. Well, if it ever opens the freaking package. There we go. Most of what I'm going to look at here is freeware. I will mention some of the paid stuff just so you'll have some references to it. But for crying out loud, will you open up? It's nice, nice. I wonder if I'm just getting some of that. Oh, hang on. I'm going to need two copies. You're going to hear my stream of consciousness. So this is the moon pretty much right now. And you can see here it put the names on things. You can actually impress your neighbors and say, yes, there is Mary Trent for the pulse. And see, Neil Armstrong set foot right around there. Ain't that cool? Yeah, never mind. Better be. So this is a nice full package. It will give you a nice idea of what's visible on the moon. You can go in as deep as you like and pick out stuff on the moon and give you a sense of what it is you're looking at. The image here is photographic, so this is a very good reference of what you might get. Now, to get images like this of the moon for your backyard is tougher than you might imagine, because the moon is affected badly by atmospheric effects. So here you will have to do a fair bit of image stacking to get a nice image. And it's tricky, but it's certainly quite doable. I tend to like the moon simply because it's constantly changing. This terminator line here, the line between light and dark, moves at 15 kilometers an hour. So within about 15 minutes, the shadows will change. And what you're seeing here near the terminator will look vastly different in about an hour. And coming up on first quarter, what you'll discover is we're going over some of the really cool bits of landscape. For example, up here near the edge, you're going to watch mountains and crater edges pop out as you're watching, which is a really, really cool thing to contemplate. Now, this is a little on the odd side with the screen sharing thing. Now, Andrea mentioned Stellarium. You can use Stellarium Web. You can get Stellarium for cell phones. The basic one is Stellarium for basic desktop and laptop computers. It's available for PC, Mac, and Linux, and each one looks roughly the same. The basic user interface is a bit old school. Now, what I'm used to for the Ottawa PC Users Group is a bunch of old school guys who used to play with command lines and all that old stuff. I'm probably dating myself terribly, but restating myself as a cheap date, never mind, forget it. So here is Stellarium. And one of the nice things about Stellarium is, as Andrea mentioned, it's free. You might have to pay a couple of dollars for tablets. If you're paying any more than that, you are being ripped off. There are some outfits that will sell you Stellarium at atrocious prices. The last time I checked, you can get Stellarium, the basic version, for $3. And if you're paying any more than that, you are probably being ripped off. The other nice thing about Stellarium is it's very close to photorealistic. I'm running a reduced screen here, just so I can access the rest of the screen to pick up other things. But you can go full screen if you want, and it gives you a nice immersive view. Now, just looking at this, you get the same effect that most people have, in that you're lost. So it's kind of handy to be able to turn on features. And this Stellarium, what you'll do is drag your mouse here to the lower left. And that brings up the windows here on the side, location, date, time, sky and viewing options, and the icons down here in the bottom. So I'm just going to turn on the standard stuff, constellations, constellation names. You can turn on constellation art if you like. I find it clutters things up, so I tend not to. And we're going to turn on star labels and planet labels. Now, if you're having trouble with this, there's a help command here, and the help window is really comprehensive. So you can just scroll down here. You can also configure practically anything you want. And in the newest versions, you'll find most stuff you can pull up from the toolbar. So what this is doing right now is this is giving you the time as it pulls it off your computer. That's the way it will default. And rolling your mouse or using the plus and page up and page down keys can zoom in quite nicely. Here we have the moon near first quarter, and if you zoom in, you'll actually see we get a pretty decent photorealistic moon. And you can actually get names for lunar features with it. Ah, and you'll notice here the moon is moving around behind you. So there's a couple of ways around that. We can have it track the moon and just keep following it. Or we can kill the time, freeze it dead. Or we can also run very, very fast, which can be really fun, for example, if you want to study things like the motion of the moons of Jupiter. So Stellarium pretty much does it all, but like any planetarium software, you'll find that there's a fairly hefty learning curve to it, and there's really no way around this. If it's going to be a useful, comprehensive program, you're going to discover there has to be something of a learning curve. It does help you in some regards. Suppose we see something here. Here's an interesting star, and you'll notice, I don't know how well this comes across in the screen sharing, but Stellarium tries to give you a hint of star flickering. And you can sort of see this star here is flickering a little bit. If you turn off the atmosphere effects, the flickering's gone. And it will actually try to simulate light pollution. You can specify the amount of light pollution you want, so you can get a sense of what it is you're going to be seeing. So let's click on this one. And this tells us that we have a star here, and the color is roughly what we're going to see outside. And up here we see this incredible mind-numbing list. It's Fomalhaut, that's the basic name, and here we have names from other cultures, and down here we have a staggeringly huge mass of catalog numbers, most of which you can ignore. The first couple are the ones, the first two or three are the ones that you're going to use most often. And down here you also have what, when you start out, most people will find a mind-numbing amount of data. Now, one of the things that you have a problem with in the sky is trying to figure out how far apart everything is. You're looking at a screen, and the real sky doesn't quite look like that. So we can do a couple of things to get around that. We can turn on grids. And this one is a grid in terms of what we call alt-az, in other words, lines of altitude, in other words, how high up and down you're looking, and azimuth, your compass direction. That's nice because it's tied to the ground, and it's kind of an obvious thing. Or we could also turn on the equatorial grid, and that is tied to the North Star, which, as Andrew has pointed out, this is what you're going to worry about when you're trying to guide the telescopes. you might also want to figure out, well, okay, I'm out there in the sky. How do I describe where things are? Well, you can also do this in terms of angles. And you can put on an angular measurement tool. Here we discover that Flamalote is 25 degrees, 22 degrees from Jupiter. And how much is 22 degrees? Well, it turns out there's a really easy way to solve that, and it's called your hand. Not doing too well with the cell phone, with the speak for crying out loud, with the webcam. But basically, your hand in front of you covers the same amount of sky as my hand and Andrea's hand and Tom's hand and Wayne's hand and Timothy's hand and everybody else's hand. And if you stick three fingers up like a Boy Scout salute, that's 5 degrees. Your fist is 10 degrees. Hitchhiking is 15 degrees. And that's how far something will move in the sky in 1 hour. So there you go. You've now got a nice little reference line in your hand, which you can now represent in Stellarium by just dragging the numbers around. So we can see here, that's going to be about two fist widths. Jupiter's about two fist widths away from Flamalote. How do you know it's Jupiter? Well, you notice that Flamalote is twinkling and Jupiter isn't. And Stellarium does a pretty nice job of that, too. Stars, in general, twinkle, and planets don't twinkle so much. Some people say they don't twinkle, they actually do, but just planets are twinkling, you might just really get up. And it's a nice shot anyway. Here's a nice view of Jupiter. Come on. Thank you. I talked to myself. I used to be an engineer. Take a look here. You can see here how the background grid is moving because it's tied to the sky. Jupiter is actually moving to the sky. I'm going to turn that grid off because the air grid is all right. Now, you might be wondering, what am I going to see? Well, this is where you can set Stellarium up quite nicely because you can turn on various fields of view. This one is one of the standard ones. It's an EOS, a Canon EOS 450D, and this is what you would see through a Canon EOS 450D with a standard, whatever standard lens it comes with. This box here is basically the view. This is what you can expect to see through that panel. You can set this up any way you want. I'll turn this off. There's another useful one here. Now, Andrea had this on a telescope. You might not have noticed it. It's a boxy thing called a Telrad, and it's one of the nicer little pointing widgets. Now, I'm just going to open up a little PowerPoint here on my screen so you can take a look at it. And this is going to show you how you're going to go and hook up the camera. I'll show you how to hook up two different cameras. There we go. The trick here, I've just got the side scan here so you can get a quick view of what we're doing. The trick is to take the lens off your camera and use a mount adapter for it. And connect that mount adapter to an eyepiece adapter, which you can then put in your telescope. When you're hooking up your telescope and a camera, you're basically turning the telescope into a honking big telephoto lens. And this is the result. This is actually, I've taken the focusing assembly off my camera, off my telescope, one of my telescopes, so you can see how it hooks up. And here it's just bolted into the telescope. If you might complain, but a 2-inch eyepieces are really horrendously expensive and I don't have one. Well, that's okay, we got you covered. Because where there's a will, there's an adapter. And there's all kinds of ways we can hook those cameras up. So DSLR has become a very, very attractive way to get, actually quite a bit of astrophotography with very bright objects. And even not terribly bright objects. You'll find a lot of the astrophotographers with the RASC are now using DSLRs, some of which have been adapted to work for astrophotography. Basically, the DSLRs typically come with a little filter inside, and you can actually modify them and take the filter out. So you get a better astrophotography. If you didn't want to use that, here is a small camera. This one's actually out of production now, the whole field moves so rapidly. You can see I put a little ruler here on the side. This is a nice little camera. It's about 1280 by 720. And it's a USB 3 camera, so it operates quite rapidly. You can get a very nice video with that. And that's one nice way to get the stack imaging in, to have your stacking software unpack a video. So instead of taking 1,600 photographs, and that's not unusual, for example, if you're trying to stabilize a sun, a picture of the sun, I do a lot of solar astronomy just for fun, with solar filters, I should point out. You would pack them together and throw away the image, the frames that you don't like, stack together the frames that you do like, and all this stuff can be done by software. So this becomes a very effective way to do it. And here you can see that camera tucked right into the focusing assembly from the telescope. There'd be a USB 3 cable coming off here. And you can get full, if your computer is up to handling the data flow, and that depends entirely on how badly loaded your computer is. I use a laptop with practically nothing else on it, and I can get a good 30 frames a second without any real trouble, and 60 frames a second if I'm good at cleaning up the crap that Windows leaves behind. Now, these little pointing gadgets down here, this is the box that you saw attached on the side of Andrea's telescope. What you do is you aim this to the sky and you look right through this glass plate, and it superimposes this reticle pattern on the sky. And this is probably one of the nicest ways I can think of aiming your telescope. Unfortunately, this box is a little big, and don't ask me why I didn't put a ruler on with it, but this is about the length of my hand. And if you have a small telescope, it's a bit clunky. So for that, there's the smaller quick finder, which has this, it works the same way. I like putting a box on it, a battery box on it. It normally comes with coin batteries that it gobbles at a ferocious rate, whereas a pair of alkalines will run for, run for months. And it will put this reticle pattern on the sky. It makes your life an awful lot easier in terms of being able to find your way around the sky and get your telescope pointed and aligned to begin with. Plate solving that Andrea mentions, it's actually improved a lot since the last time I looked at it. It used to be for the mortals. It wasn't anything that we were going to do in real time. Sounds like right now it's gotten much better than the last time I looked about 10 years ago. So it's something we're going to have to check out again. But, even if you've got all the fancy stuff, you've got to know your way around the sky at least a little bit, because otherwise you're always going to be getting lost, and little details like this really, really help. So this is what we're looking at here for the reticle. This is a Telrad reticle, and this is exactly what you would see looking through the reticle on the sky. So this is one of the great ways you can use to find your way around. Now, this is one of many pieces of software. I could spend hours showing you to do this. I teach an astronomy course for Loyalist College. I devote about 3 hours to just 2 weeks worth of introductions to Stellarium, and it's enough to get you started. The best way to do this is go and play with it. It's a marvelous, fun thing to play with. Just go play and look and click on things and get information from things. It comes with quite a few pictures built in, but you can also link to all kinds of pictures out in the great unknown. You can also simulate things from any other place in the planet, which is quite interesting, particularly if you're teaching a course, as I do. For example, if you want to see what things look like from Chile, we're going to do that. Location window, and let's head down to roughly Cerro Pachón, Chile. That's where the Gemini 8-meter telescope is, and here's roughly what you see from Chile. Constellations you've never heard of before, Pavo and Chameleon. But then if you look to the north, you'll see a few things here like Pegasus the Flying Horse, except now he's right side up instead of upside down, because that's the delivery of the southern hemisphere sky. And we're just going to go back home again. Great little piece of software, marvelous fun, and you cannot, absolutely cannot beat the price, which is free. you'll find it's upgraded routinely. Every month or so, expect an upgrade. The upgrades are usually fairly small. Now, Andrea mentioned the ASI Air, which is her little box top computer. There is another version of that, which I was mentioning, and it's one intended for people who already have ArcPies sitting at home. So what I've got here is an ArcPy 4 and an ArcPy 4 box, and you can run StellarMate, which does basically all the stuff that's in the ASI Air. One little nasty aspect of ASI Air is it's the last time I checked, anyway, it only works with ZWO brand cameras, and StellarMate runs with everything. So that's a nice thing to consider. There are now we're having trouble. Welcome to StellarMate. There we go. Now you can buy a box StellarMate on Isle of Wretched Pelican Droppings. Here we go. You can buy the box if you want, and it looks remarkably like ASI Air because it's pretty much the same thing. Or you can just buy the software package yourself and install it on a Raspberry Pi, since I happen to have Raspberry Pis probably more than I really should have. I decided to go for that route. And it is a nice full package. It's got all the software built into it that you will need to run your programs, run your software. And in there is a planetarium program called KSTARS, which you can run on Macs and Windows and Linux, and it's free. And the nice part about it is it matches perfectly what you're going to find on ASI Air and on StellarMate. So what you're getting used to here, it's not as pretty as it's not anywhere near as pretty as Stellarium. It does the job quite perfectly. I mean, it does everything you'd expect of it, but it also provides a link. You see this little observatory icon? This will give you a link through Wi-Fi to your ASI Air or your StellarMate box. So you've got all kinds of, I haven't got mine turned on at the moment, as you can see. I mean, it's unplugged and dead. Ooh, wow, that's kind of cool. Now, something that you might want to consider, again, I'm not sure how much you folks are into the home blue line anymore, but if you are, honestly, there's only one reason to do home blue, and that's because you think it's fun. You're not likely to build something that's going to work as well as something you're going to buy, but it can be a very interesting and fun way to do things. Your go-to widget is the stepper motor, which you can use then to automate practically anything you want. There is an excellent source of open software from an outfit called OnStep. I can't see a chat window here, so I don't know if you're running it through, but OnStep provides the package that does all the necessary guiding stuff. Even if you don't, you'd be amazed at what you can do if you simply run a stepper motor at a fixed rate for 5 or 10 minutes. And that will actually keep a stepper motor, any motor, that will actually keep your mount tracking for, you know, not terribly well, but not terribly badly. I've done some experimenting with it. You can keep it going for about 5 minutes if you've got a nice delicate touch with a speed control, just a manual speed control. Now, to drive these things, my personal favorite solution right now is the Adafruit Feather line. No, I do not have shares in Adafruit, but I spend enough money there that I probably should. These are lovely little, tiny little wings, as they call them. You can get all kinds of stuff, like a tiny little display, a real-time clock, any number of processors, including some wonderful 32-bit ARM processors, which will have more than enough horsepower to do practically anything you would like to do. and they all run through the Arduino software, the standard Arduino software kit. You just download the proper board, and you can now do all the programming you want. So your options are endless. It's easy enough to even do the programming. This is an example of one thing I was doing here. What I have here is a driver card for an 8-inch LCD touchpad. And I'm just using an Arduino form factor for just to do the development on my desktop. So there's all kinds of options that are fairly inexpensive that will give you a chance to build whatever widgets you could want. And if you start with a basically decent mount to begin with, the mount is key. You can have the telescope is the easy part. The mount is what gives you your performance. The mount has to be stable. The mount has to be solid. The mount has to be repeatable and work well. Most of the mounts you buy, and this is the typical problem buying stuff from stores, from big box stores, the mounts are typically junk. So if you go out and buy a nice, solid, basic mount and hang a stepper motor on it, you're well on the way to having something that you can use to have a little bit of fun outside and actually do get a little bit of short-term astrophotography. So this is some of the homebrew stuff that I've been playing with. I've been looking at modifying some of my existing stuff as much as anything simply because it's fun. Honestly, I can't beat the performance of packaged mounts and packaged software. This is the stuff that Andrea is using. But if you find this sort of thing fun and enjoyable, and I expect you do since you're PC user group, then this can be a really interesting and relatively inexpensive way to get going. And the resources available are enormous out there for being able to handle this stuff. Now, I'm not sure how this will work, but if anybody's got questions, I'm more than willing to try to tackle them. How do I work this out and get questions from people?
Yeah, what I can do is I can't force an unmute on everybody. What I can do is do a mute all, which I'll do right now, and give people the ability to unmute themselves. So, Tim, you'll have to unmute yourself as well. But we will open it up so anybody can now freely unmute themselves to ask any questions, or you could throw it into the chat window if you wanted to do so. So anybody who's got a question, by all means, just jump in and do it. I don't see any other questions in the chat right now.
I've either bored everybody so spitless.
We're a quiet bunch.
Yeah, that must be it. And Andrew, you did mention PhD software for guiding. There's actually a few other options available, but PhD actually stands for Push Here Dummy. and it was originally intended as a guiding package for Dobsonian telescopes. Those are the ones that you see. Originally, they were built on orange crates, and you would put a set of encoders on them, and you would literally push them to where you wanted to go. And the Push Here Dummy software would tell you, you're coming close, you're coming close, you're coming close, you went too far. And that's exactly what it did. There was actually a little screen guide that would say, nope, too far, move back. It was a very cool piece of kit.
I didn't know that. I knew about Press Here Dummy, but I didn't realize. I thought it was pressing the button like guide.
No, it was literally push the telescope. I had PhD back when it was first done for DOPS, when I was first playing with it. And I tried to put it on my old uncomputer-guided telescope, or actually went out and bought a bunch of U.S. robotics encoders and bolted them onto my telescope. Under my mount, the performance was abysmally bad. I did have fun with it, but the performance stank.
There are a couple of questions.
Shoot.
I think you can speak to the Stellarium one, but I don't know if there's any way to rent high end stuff for a few weeks. I do know that there are these things called remote telescopes.
Yes, yeah. iTelescopes, for example, allows you to rent telescopes telescope farms around the world. There's one set of telescopes in Chile. There's another one in on the Canary Islands. There's another one in Australia. And you can rent the time. The prices are, they're not bad. So yeah, you can set that up. You can do all the site planning you want, all the initial planning. But the difficulty with all those ones is that very often what you'll do is you'll put through a request for an image and you'll get the image back. Only in a few cases do you actually get to use the equipment live. It's usually done on a queued system. So it's nice if you want an image, but it suffers a bit in the front. Incidentally, something else you're mentioning, guide scopes. Here's a guide scope. And the guide scope is intended to work with a ZWO camera. So here's a 30mm guide scope, which actually works remarkably well for bright stuff. So this is about $150 total. And it works nicely with Pushear Dummy software. So there's lots of good options out there that are very inexpensive. Now, it may not be obvious what the guiding does. Guiding actually sends signals back to the mount that tells it to adjust its tracking, because you'll never have your mount perfectly set up. It'll never be perfectly aligned, not unless you're in a permanent installation. So what these things do is they keep a star centered in them, and they send signals back to the telescope mount when the star appears to move. So it basically says, nope, star's not centered, go right. Star's not centered, go left. Star's not centered, go up. And the trick here is you want to keep those motions fairly small so that then you can resolve the mess out when you're doing your final stacking. I don't know if that covers that one or not. Now, is there anything anybody was wondering about Stellarium? I could play with it for ages.
Yeah, there's one question from Glenn on can Stellarium adjust the amount of light pollution in the simulation?
Yes, it can.
Yeah.
Yes, it can. You can specify the amount of light pollution. It's not trivially simple. You have to actually go through the sky configurations. But what it'll do is it has, I don't know if you're familiar with something called the Bortle scale. It's named after a fellow named John Bortle, who defined 9 levels of light pollution, from a perfect sky to light-polluted city. And what you can do with Stellarium, once it actually fires up, is specify, among other things, the Bortle level.
So I guess a follow-up to that is, if so, are parameters available for light pollution in Ottawa, mm-hmm. or even specific neighborhoods in Ottawa?
Specific neighborhoods, I do not know. There are light pollution maps for North America that are updated quite frequently. I can't think off the top of my head. A quick Google search on light pollution map, you'll find it.
I know that some of the software pieces, if they can track your location,
yeah,
and sometimes tell you what Bortle class you are. When I log into Telescopius, it always tells me I'm a Bortle 5.
Which for you and CARP is probably not too far off. Bortle 5 is not too bad. Let me try and figure out a... I've got stuff buried from my course that I'm halfway through doing a new video on light pollution. So, I don't think I'll try and do that on the cuff. But the problem I found with light pollution maps is they can all low system resources go away. I find the problem with the light pollution maps is they tend to be updated only twice daily. There are light pollution meters that you can actually get. They tend to be ridiculously overpriced. I had looked at making my own and discovered that it's one of those areas where trying to actually find the proper approach to designing a light meter is a little area of proprietary nichedom that for some reason you just can't really get the details. I'm working at it slowly, but it's taking some time. But yeah, you can go my light meters if you want. One of the ways that you can estimate your light pollution is by looking at a constellation. One of the standard ones for finding light pollution is to look for the Little Dipper and count the number of stars in it. And this is, for example, showing excellent light pollution, which I ain't got. From where I am, I can see this star, and this star. And that's about it. When I go out to CARP, I can make out everything but these two stars in most conditions. So this gives you a fairly good estimate of what your light pollution is. And there are charts that you can refer to. And again, a Google search will find them for you that will give you a simple light pollution estimate from counting the number of stars in several constellations like the Little Dipper or Cassiopeia. And that'll at least give you a gut reaction of what it's like.
Interesting. So that's a nice way to do it. Sort of a manual way of getting pretty close, I guess.
Oh, yeah. It gives you what it does is it gives you some sense of what you can hope to do. Now, I have not used Telescopius to any great extent because what I've been using, again, I've had a lot of paid stuff here. I use a package called SkyTools, which unfortunately, it's a lovely package. The guy that does it is a one-man shop in Colorado. He has done a masterful job of integrating all the zillions of catalogs and resolving the holes. And what this will do, it's just going to show an administrator here. I have this set up in double stars. I enjoy double stars. They're good fun when things are terribly light polluted and you just want a quick half hour to go out and observe something. You'd specify your equipment. Here I've specified one of my far too many telescopes. My wife is a long-suffering, strong wife who had only given me a small amount of snake eye when using telescopes. Probably less than I deserve. But come on, update this data. This zoom is really slowing stuff down. But what this package does is it does it's the planning that Andrea was mentioning. And lets you do it offline. But this does try to give you an indication of the light pollution. For example, up here, this is a bar that shows you the conditions for the night. And this has got the average light pollution for Ottawa dialed in. So this is telling you that at midnight, this is about as dark as it's going to get for my part of Ottawa. It's not going to get dark here near Barbecue Heaven. And with the moon up, you can see it's quite bright here until the moon starts to set. So if we pull up just any particular star, let's pull up Alberio. That's a nice little star. Oh, silence, silence, please, silence. It's not too bad when there's no lag, but when there is lag. So you've got all the data that you could ever want on the star. So if you're really getting into it in a serious way, this is showing the best window to observe. When it's the bars here indicate when it's basically a good time to observe Alberio and when it's just a total and utter bust. The chart here indicates how high it is in the sky. In general, you want to observe when it's as high as possible in the sky because we're looking to let the least amount of air and the least amount of crud. And you're also above most of the crud that's in your neighborhood, like houses, and neighbors' trees, and such like. Unless you're in my backyard where I'm surrounded by 80-year-old maple trees, and this time of year, I'm lucky to see anything except where a squirrel ate the foliage. That's what it is for living in a city. So
Yeah, we have an interesting comment or question from Jocelyn on, is there a project that amateurs can contribute to, a bit like Birdwatcher can help counting birds into an area? Do you know of any such projects available?
Sorry, for which? For light pollution or just as...
Well, just in astronomy in general, yeah.
Oh, my Lord, there are so many, I can't even count them.
Really?
Yeah, one of the biggest ones is called Galaxy Zoo, which is an opportunity for users to look at software, look at images, and actually try to identify galaxies and nebulas from the packages. The amateur Variable Star Association is probably one of the largest pro-am systems out there. You might not be aware of this, but virtually everything we have on variable stars is collected by amateurs. Professionals, as a rule, don't observe variable stars. They can't look at the same star night after night. They just can't do it. Amateurs can do what they damn well please. And this is where we get most of our variable star data, is from amateurs using their own gear in their backyards. Another one that's extremely popular is Scoop, for crying out loud, Supernova Watch. where you will get images from various parts of the sky taken on a regular basis. You as an amateur will then compare the images across several months and look for something that changed. Personally, to me, that sounds like work. And I don't like work, so I don't do work, so I don't do that kind of thing because I'm a lazy sod. I'd sooner go down and burn my fingers soldering up little bits of stepper motors so I can go outside and get terrible performance tracking a star. But if that happens to tickle your fancy, then you can actually go get a supernova named for you. So, there's a tremendous amount of citizen science out there, a staggering amount of it. All open. Actually, one of the great ones, for Galaxy Zoo, a young school teacher in the Netherlands found an entirely new class of stellar object, which became known as Hannes Borwerp, Hannes object. And it turns out to be an entirely new class of stellar object that had never been seen before. She had quite a bit of celebrity about 10 years ago on that one. And we now have, it's a new class of plasma around forming stars. So, there's a lot of citizen astronomy that's available. Now, for those of you who are interested in running your cameras, this is not freeware. I should point this out, this is not freeware. But there's a lovely little package here called Backyard EOS, and it's done by an Ottawa outfit called O-Telescope. They have one for Nikon as well. Those are the two cameras that are most commonly used for astrophotography, is Canons and Nikons. I'd say Canon probably outdoes Nikon a little bit, but they both do excellent cameras. And what this does is it operates your camera from your laptop, and you want to set your orders. You want to have it specify, I want to take 15 pictures separated by 5 minutes. It'll go do that. It'll go take them, store them back in your computer, and leave you available to stack them. You should be able to see an image of it here. I have not hooked my camera up to it, so it doesn't know how to connect to it. I normally run it off my laptop rather than my desktop. I have it here so I can take the data from my laptop and process it on my desktop, which runs a little faster than normally when I'm not running a carload of crap in the background. So, again, I should point out this is not free, but it's a good software package, and it's very well supported. You will notice here I also have Starry Night. This is probably the Cadillac software package. I don't use it much anymore because Stellarium does pretty much everything that Starry Night could ask of. What I do use it for is creating simulations for my coursework, because it does a far better job of that than Stellarium does. The entry price on that is about $90. So, this is not cheap stuff. This full package, Pro Plus, is at the $200-odd range. Actually, $300-odd range. The only reason I have it is I did beta testing for them a few years ago, and they still give me a decent price on renewing it. But otherwise, I wouldn't buy it. What can I tell you? Really, Stellarium does pretty much everything that Starry Night will do, unless you really want some good sophisticated simulation. Is there anybody out there who is interested at all in spectroscopy?
Feel free to unmute yourself or jump into the chat.
Because spectroscopy is something that can be done quite nicely with a DSLR. A $200 diffraction grating bolted into the front of a DSLR can get you an awful lot of stellar spectra, which can tell you a tremendous amount about how stars are put together. I do this for fun. I'm a spectroscopy nut. Of course, I'm a moon nut as well, stellar evolution nut. Actually, I guess I'm just a nut. But here we go. Here's a very slowly spinning Starry Night. If you really feel the need to plunk down $80 to $300, go right ahead. I salute you. but nowadays, the cheaper options, I think, do just as well for practically anybody, particularly now that Stellarium actually communicates with telescopes. Up to about 5 years ago, it did a terrible job of communicating with telescopes. They've now got their ASCOM driver, so it's sorted out quite nicely. Now, another thing to mention, too, is Andrea was mentioning ASCOM. What ASI Air and StellarMate both use is not ASCOM, but INDI, INDI. ASCOM and INDI are not compatible. However, they both operate pretty much the same mass of software. When they communicate with your hand controller, what they're doing is they're actually sending celestial data. So in other words, they're simply sending, I want you to go to this spot in the sky. And it becomes standard independent. This is how the two of them work out together. But ASI Air doesn't exactly play directly with ASCOM, which was something I discovered the hard way by trying to make it work with ASCOM, which, trust me, does not. I feel like I'm sitting here boring everybody spitless. So
I don't think so. You're getting a lot of comments, great presentation, and so forth from people. So I think you've certainly entertained people, and I think we've covered off most of the questions. I think there were a couple that Andrea jumped in on noise reduction tools,
right?
Using the ones in PixInsight, saying that some people use Topaz Denoise.
Oh, Topaz Denoise. Oh, my flaming oath. Topaz Denoise, particularly the AI version. I do graphic design when I'm not burning my eyes out on astronomy. Actually, I shouldn't be saying that right now because I haven't been able to do much astronomy because of my eyes, but that's another story. Topaz, the AI is the most expensive stuff they've got. The AI line is the most expensive stuff they've got. Their lower-end stuff is almost as good. This stuff is crown jewel in noise reduction. Fantastic stuff. And what I discovered when I had a problem with this stuff earlier, here we are. They do upvotes enough that it's annoying. I really shouldn't get into this, but hey, for a PC users group, we'll try. You know how to tell the difference between a Linux user, a Mac user, and a Windows user?
We'll let you tell us.
Okay. The Linux user says, okay, fine, an update. I guess I'll do it when I get around to it. The Windows user says, oh my God, no, not another update. And the Mac user says, oh boy, an update, that's only $100.
Very good. Just going on with the noise reduction, I happen to be a user of On1 Photo Raw, and their latest update, Photo Raw 2022, has built-in noise reduction. That seems to be pretty good. I don't know for Astro work, but for other work, it seems to be doing a pretty good job.
The trick with noise reduction for Astro work, this is where the stacking really comes in.
Yeah.
The math isn't terribly obvious. It's a trick in the way that digital images are produced. Somebody had asked earlier if it was necessary to move around to avoid sensor noise. There's actually a technique called dithering that does get around that problem, but it's that more handles things like fixed patterns built into the sensors. For example, if you've got systematic pattern deficits in the sensor, which happen a lot in some of the commercial, professional stuff, because you're dealing with super high-end stuff, and even a small variation can make a huge difference to the professional stuff. What happens is basically every image you reset the noise counter, as it were. And when you add the images up, what's happening is it turns out that the noise adds by the sum of the noise adds is the sum of the number of stacks, but the signal adds as 1/√2. So you're adding signal faster than you're adding noise. There is a threshold to it, and this is what the SkyTools imaging does for you. This actually specifies, it helps you calculate the number of images at which you're hitting the wall. Below a certain number of images, you don't get any improvement because you don't have enough to work with. Beyond, you're hitting the point where the two curves meet.
And interesting.
Yeah, so there is a sweet point. Most of us amateurs don't have to worry about it. But what the big thing stacking does is it lets us work from crummy light polluted sites, because instead of getting an hour and picking up an hour's worth of background noise, we're picking up 5 minutes of background noise and 5 minutes of background noise and 5 minutes of background noise. And we're adding the background noise up more slowly than we're adding the signal.
Very cool.
That's the trick. So this is how people like Bob Gendler, for example, he's probably one of the best astrophotographers around, he images from a Connecticut driveway. With a big telescope and a lot of stacking. So okay. stacking's the key. Now, for stacking, Andrea has mentioned Deep Sky Stacker. The gold standard is Registax, which is also free. The only problem with Registax is the learning curve is steeper than the north flank of Mount freaking Everest. Actually, it's probably steeper than the Abruzzi Ridge in K2. And there are some tutorials which are clearer than mud. However, this is the de facto image package. For example, if you buy the camera I showed you before, the Skyris camera, it comes packaged with Registax. And what this will do is this will take a video, unpack the frames, and do the stacking. And even if you just take it out of the box, it'll do a half-decent job of stacking for you. Deep Sky Stacker, not quite as good, but it works just as, you know, it does pretty much the same thing for you. It's just, it can't quite cover all the range of cases that Registax, but on the other hand, it's nowhere near as hard to use. You know, there are some things I have been told by some people who are very, very good at astrophotography, and remember, I'm not. I'm awful at it. I just have fun with it and then throw away the images and destroy the evidence, but I do have fun with it. I have been told by some experts that this will run into limits with this if you're doing really, really, really deep. In other words, really, really dim stuff, and then you'll probably want to use Registax. Or for planetary, it doesn't look terribly well. Planetary is a whole different beast, and frankly, it's not one that I really know how to do very well.
Well, we are at the hour, so I think if there was one last question throw out your way. Glenn wanted to know if the Pi camera could be made to work for astrophotography.
Abso-freaking-lutely, particularly the high-res camera. And there's a beautiful little mount that's available for it. Damn it, where do I have that? ArcPy, HQ camera and C-mount ones. There we go. There's a lovely little mount that you can bolt onto it, a nice little plate that will let you bolt on. But yeah, the high-resolution camera, you actually can use it quite nicely for astrophotography. And if you put a CS mount adapter on it, you can just slip it into a 2.5-inch eyepiece. And it works quite nicely. You're not going to get super faint stuff with it because the noise is a little high. But, for example, if you want nice images, it'll do fine. Images of bright nebulas, like the Orion Nebula, it'll probably do fine. Jupiter, Saturn, you're probably okay with it. But yeah, you can do it. No problem. The basic, like the Pi Noir, the old ones, I haven't tried them, and I haven't seen anything about them. It certainly would be worth a try. I mean, I've seen people get some remarkably good results just aiming their cell phone cameras into an eyepiece. It's amazing what you can get even with that. So, you know, my best suggestion is give it a shot. The worst that happens is you have bits, no pun intended, sorry. You'll have bits that you throw into the bit bucket and pretend aren't yours.
Yes, good point.
That's the nice part with all this. Getting going is not that hard because you can get surprisingly good stuff in 5 minutes.
Wonderful.
That's the fun part.
Yeah. Very cool. Okay, I think we should wrap it up for the evening. So I would like to extend my sincere thanks, and there's tons of thanks and kudos in the chat window there. But I would like to pass on my thanks to Tim and Andrea for a truly fascinating presentation. It was really great. I learned a lot. Maybe some that, maybe I don't want to work that hard, but...
I'm a lazy cuss. I mean, you can't be as lazy as I am.
It's not work. It's fun. You'll have fun.
Exactly. Well, no, I only do fun stuff.
Yeah, it is fascinating. It truly is fascinating.
If you've got questions afterwards, by the way, just pass them on. If I can't give you an answer, I will come up with a very amusing lie. seriously speaking, though, all gags aside, I mean, I will be happy to try to research what I can. My background is electrical engineering. I did do image processing work. I still do image processing on the side, mostly for fun. I know it sounds crazy for fun, but that's what I do for fun. So I'm perfectly happy if you've got questions that I'll certainly give them a shot. And no, you know, seriously speaking, if I can't give you an answer, I will try to find somebody who will. There's an awful lot of resources in the area. See, we've got people who range everywhere from we've got professional astrophysicists in the group.
Wow.
There's expertise everywhere in the group. And then nationally, there's experts all over. We have some of the really spectacular astrophotographers in here. I mean, Andrea's stuff blows my mind. She's doing stuff that I wouldn't have imagined being able to do with some of the commercial stuff that's available. And I was working on the club's robotics telescope about 20 years back. The state of the art's really changed. So by all means, if you've got questions, pass them on. I'll be glad to take a shot at them.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you very, very kindly for offering to do so. That's much, much appreciated.
My pleasure.
And again, our thanks. And happy astro work.
Astrowing.
Astrowing, yes, whatever.
Yeah, that's the one.
Thank you.
Thanks kindly.
Great job, Andrea, and I am awestruck by your stuff. I'm in
awe. I just started about a year and a half ago.
Oh, FYI. Wow.
So this is all new technology. It's made it a lot easier for people to get in. So I think I just wanted to put that out. It's not like I've been doing this for a decade. I'm very new, but I've taken advantage of the new technology.
Which a lot of people haven't. There's stuff there I've never heard of. So, this is nice for cross-pollination. And we're going away now.
Astounding. Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Good night, all.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Great presentation.
Okay, folks, just wrapping up, just a reminder, next week's Q&A will be at its regular time on Wednesday evening at 7:30. So hope to see everybody out there.